Already? Okay. Good evening. My name is Dan Olson, and I'm the county's hearings officer. I'll go ahead and open tonight's hearing. This is an application for a comprehensive plan amendment to change the designation of the subject property from surface mine to rural residential exception area and a zone change from surface mining to multiple use agricultural. It includes removing surface mining site number 357 from the surface mining mineral and aggregate inventory, adding it to the non-significant mining and aggregate inventory, and removing the associated surface mining impact area combining zone. The applicant is the Tumalo Irrigation District, and the case numbers are 247-17-00075-ZC and 247-17-00776-PA. And the hearing will proceed as follows. The county staff will identify the applicable criteria, summarize the proposed requests, and the staff recommendations. The applicant or the applicant's representative will then have an opportunity to testify, to explain the proposal, respond to county staff, submit any new evidence. So after we hear from the applicant, I'll next call on anyone speaking in favor of the application. I will then hear from those who are opposed or who are uncertain or who may just have questions about the application. And staff will have an opportunity for final comments, and then finally we'll hear from the applicant's final rebuttal. If you have written material to submit, please hand it to the staff either before or after you testify. She will mark it with a case and exhibit number, and it will become part of the official record. State law provides that failure to raise an issue orally or in writing before the close of the record with enough specificity that I am able to respond to the issue may preclude you from raising that issue in a later appeal. State law also provides that failure of the applicant to raise constitutional or other issues relating to a proposed condition of approval with sufficient specificity to allow me to respond to that issue may preclude an action for damages in circuit court. I'm going to explain this more at the end of the testimony, but note that any party has a right to request a continuance of the hearing or that the record be held open for at least 7 days. If you have additional evidence that you wish to submit or need additional time to respond to evidence submitted tonight, you must do that before the close of tonight's record. Every party of record will receive notice of the decision, including an explanation of appeal rights. I have no conflicts of interest. I've had no ex parte contacts concerning this application, and I did not conduct a site visit. All I know about the application is what I've read in the staff report and the documents posted online on development docs. And then I received this evening so far anyway a December 10th letter from Robert Lund Jr. and a first supplemental burden of proof from the applicant. My job is to apply the standards and criteria in the code and any applicable laws. I am not a policy maker. So please address your testimony to the applicable criteria set out in the staff report or explain why you believe other criteria may apply. Please note that you may submit written comments rather than testify. You may sign in on the sign-up sheet and become a party without testifying. If your comments are similar to someone else's, you're welcome to just indicate that you agree with a prior speaker. The applicant does have the burden of proof on this matter. And so if you wish to speak, please come forward to the microphone, state your full name and last name, including your last name, spelling your last name, and give your address with zip code. If you represent a group, please indicate who you are representing. So before we get started with the staff report, does anyone wish to raise any procedural concerns or challenge my ability to conduct this hearing tonight? All right, seeing none, let's go with the staff report.
So I just put a very brief PowerPoint together, just more for maps for reference, so we can keep it up afterwards. Cynthia Smith with the County Planning Division. As you indicated, Dan, the file numbers in the case are 247-17-000775-ZC and 776-PA. The applicant is Tumalo Irrigation District, and they are represented by attorney Garrett Krostek. The applicant does request a plan amendment and zone change for approximately 541 acres just north of Tumalo Reservoir Road, consisting of three tax lots, and I'll have a map in a minute. The request would change the plan designation and the zoning from surface mining to rural residential exception area and multiple use agricultural, respectively. The request does not include an exception to a statewide planning goal, since the current plan designation is not agriculture or forest lands. Staff will rely on the prior circulation of the written staff report. I've provided a few copies over on the table near the door. And with regards to the proposal and the applicable criteria, they're all listed in there. As indicated in the staff report, staff believes that the applicant has met the burden of proof necessary to justify the proposed change. However, there's one area of the proposal could use some clarification, and that is whether the hearings officer believes the Dogami designation planned post-mining beneficial use, quote unquote, influences how the change in classification is consistent with the purpose and the intent of the proposed zoning of MUA 10. Yesterday, the applicant did provide a supplemental burden of proof addressing this issue and issues raised by the public and other agencies. I did provide a copy of this document to the hearings officer. I don't think he's had a chance to look at it. I will let the applicant or their attorney address the findings or summarize those and other issues that they feel like. Notice of tonight's hearing and the subject application was mailed to surrounding property owners within 750 feet and to public agencies and to parties of interest. Staff received that other comment by Bob Lund, I believe it was,
yes.
And that's also provided. I just want to mention, if you are going to testify, if you could, when you come up, just fill out the form here, and so we have record of it, and legibly would be preferred, so I can then get back to you with additional information if I need to. And that concludes my presentation brief. If you have any other questions.
The supplemental burden of proof and this letter from Mr. Lund, they're not, I don't think they're on dial. Should I mark these as hearings exhibits? How do you normally do that?
I did put them in. They have been put in. They have been scanned into the file. They're just not. They're not showing on dial yet.
Okay. So they're already in. All right.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Okay.
Lastly, I forgot to put up the map here. This shows the three tax lots. Larger parcel is tax lot 10,400, and then there's 10,300, and then there's tax lot 100. I also included here, and if the applicant wants to use this, just this came out of your the assessment. Just kind of shows the surface mine. I don't know if we want to keep that up there or not, but just for perspective of the mining activity, pumice mining boundary, cinder mining boundary, and the proposed the subject property, just as a different visual so we can go between the two if we want.
I did have a couple of questions. On page 9 of the staff report, it says the surface mining element and the ESEE analysis for site number 357 do not identify a subsequent use zone. Is that unusual or fairly typical? Do you know?
I think it's a mix. Back then, I don't. When they were doing the ECs, they some of them had it and some of them didn't.
Okay. And then I wasn't sure. The comment on page 12. If you could. Says current Dogami procedures require the operator applicant of the Dogami permit to identify the planned post-mining beneficial use. Staff's uncertain of the reasoning behind the designated post-mining use for site number 357 and if this is a consideration. And you indicated that's the issue. Can you just explain what the concern is there a little bit?
Mr. and Mrs. Holt brought this to staff's attention, and so I just I did some brief research to see who chooses that designation. And current rules show that the mine operator, when they're filling out their reclamation paperwork, that they choose what that designation or the beneficial use, the planned post-mining beneficial use. As staff interpreted it at a high level, that the mine operator is the one who chooses that or selects that option, whatever it is, whether it's housing or construction or open space, or there are several choices there. And when the Tumalo Irrigation District, when they started their reclamation process, I don't know if it was the same back then. We could assume that that was what happened back then. They chose what it was going to be. Why they chose that, that's what it is. It's uncertain. Maybe the attorney or Tumalo Irrigation District can respond to that. And whether or not it really has an impact in this plan amendment and zone change. And I know the applicant's attorney did address that in their supplemental. I briefly went over that today, and I'll let them talk more about that. So it was more of just, does this really have an impact on this proposal before us?
Okay, great. Thank you.
Do you want me to move this up here?
All right, let's go ahead and hear from the applicant and the applicant's representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Hearings Officer. For the record, Garrett Krostek of the law firm of Bryant, Loveland, and Jarvis, proud to present the application on behalf of Tumalo Irrigation District. So before hopping into the merits of this, I guess we wanted to set out the reason that we're here. Tumalo Irrigation District is not ordinarily in the land development, land use field. Tumalo Irrigation District is an irrigation district. Our mission is to serve our patrons with irrigation water and to be good stewards of the water resource. And it's the water resource that really drives this application. The subject property is an asset of the district. There is no clear plans for it yet, but the idea is to use this asset to engage in conservation projects throughout the district that will conserve water and help put it back in stream for in-stream uses. So some background on the site. It's been operated as mine for a long time, and in the earliest county records, it had always been zoned surface mining. Getting to the question raised earlier, why wasn't there a post use in the ESEE? I'm not sure that was ever a requirement back then. My from reviewing it myself, the only reason I've seen that come across is that nowadays is that if you went to apply for a Goal 5 surface mine, you have to identify a post-use which is supposed to be consistent with whatever was on the books at the time. As far as we are aware, there was never a choice to designate a post-use because that wasn't part of the process back then. I think that was something that just was on the form, and when the inspector went out to certify that reclamation had been done, he checked the box because that was on the form. So our obligation to rezone this property is to show that there are no resources left. We've submitted into the record a report from Siemens & Associate, who are some geotechnical engineers and who have been working out on that site for a long time, studying the material out there. They've concluded the resource probably never initially qualified as significant, but to the extent it ever did, a lot of material has been removed, probably more so than was ever thought to be in there, according to the table in the county plan about this particular site. So the resource is exhausted. So now that it can no longer be used towards commercial mining type purposes, we're coming forward with a two-part proposal. The one is the rezone redesignation from surface mining to MUA-10 rural residential exception. This was selected because it's the best fit amongst the options available to available under the county's zoning regime. It's one that recognizes a desire to preserve a rural aesthetic, that there should be some opportunities to engage in agriculture, but a recognition that this is not going to be commercially viable agriculture. And if you read further into the purpose statement in Deschutes County Code section 18.32.010, it answers what I thought were some of the questions raised in the staff report about how this particular zoning advances the interests of preserving resources and that sort of thing. There are no current development plans. From the outset, I explained that the district views this as an asset, how it's going to be used in post zoning. There's no specific plans at this point. The district has done some conceptual level planning, but nothing's been formally adopted by the Irrigation District Board. Most of what has been contemplated is cluster style developments, which are permitted use under the MUA 10. And the reason for that is, one, it helps preserve open space and larger areas of, and condenses where development occurs, such that it's more compact and less impactful from a scenic, wildlife, et cetera, all those considerations. But again, nothing has been firmly put into motion as of yet. The other part of the proposal is to shift the site from the significant Goal 5 resource to the non-significant Goal 5 resource. And the reason why this has to occur is that essentially there's been some tighter interpretations of what in fact constitutes surface mining, and some would argue that building a reservoir and even maybe engaging in piping constitutes surface mining. The only way you can engage in any type of surface mining of non-Goal 5 resources is if you are included on the non-Goal 5 inventory. Again, similar, there are no immediate plans to do anything of that type on this site, but it's a realistic enough possibility that we need to take this opportunity to get on this list. As you'll read further in the first supplemental burden of proof, that whole structure is a little archaic and largely been struck down by the courts, but it's on the books, so that we want to take that issue off the table, and that's why it's part of this. And I guess the third part, which is certainly in the application, the staff report, but of course is the removal of the surface mining impact overlay that is associated with this mining site, since it will no longer be a significant Goal 5 resource should this application be approved. We concur with the vast majority of the staff report as far as why this proposal is consistent with the applicable criteria. So I'm not going to go into any detail on any of those, but I guess I will touch on what I've seen thus far in the record from staff and from some of the commentators. So the open space / Dogami question. So Dogami has no land use planning authority of any type. There's, from my review, there's nothing that says they control post-mining uses. I haven't seen any statutes or anything that would say otherwise. And frankly, it would seem kind of strange for, well, rather the county, subject to the statewide land use goals, the county is who holds land use authority. That's why we're here, to select a proper zoning for it. And it would seem strange that the county would yield its land use planning authority to a statement in a Dogami certificate, absent some express authority that Dogami does, in fact, have some regulatory authority over land use. But they don't. What they do is they oversee mining operations and, important here, reclamation. The site has been reclaimed to Dogami standards. And it is ready to be moved into some post-mining use. The commentators, well, I'm sure we'll hear more about it, but we think that the MUA 10 zoning addresses the open space issues that have been raised in the comments. It only allows a very narrow, limited amount of development. It has a large minimum lot size, 10 acres, and it's very likely, as the district has looked into it, if they were to go any further, that cluster developments make the most sense, and that would yield lots of open space. So we don't think there's any need for any special regulations associated with open space. We think that's the function of the MUA 10, which addresses open space in the purpose statement, adequately addresses all those concerns. There was another comment about applying landscape management overlay to the entirety of the property. In response to that, I would say that the county has already made determination as to which properties should be subject to the landscape management zone, and those are largely relate to some resource that's already been identified in the comprehensive plan. This, other than its mining resource, and is documented in the staff report, the site is not associated with any other form of Goal 5 type resources, scenic views, wildlife habitat, any of those things. So the landscape management is designed to protect those things. Those don't seem applicable here, so it would not be appropriate to add a landscape management zone when the county commissioners have already made a decision that this one they didn't originally place it on this list. A lot has been said about hazards and/or buildability of the site. To that, we concur with what's in the staff report, in that this has been reclaimed to Dogami standards. that the area isn't otherwise identified as having some extraordinary natural hazard risk, and that in prior decisions, which we believe should be upheld again or applied again in this scenario, is that those types of issues are best evaluated when there's some physical form of development proffered for the property. At that stage, that's when licensed engineers are submitting grading, drainage, physical improvement type plans, and it can be better evaluated what, if anything, additional is needed to address site circumstances out there. Finally, there are a number of comments about traffic and traffic analysis. I think a lot of those confuse the purpose or the requirements for traffic analysis in a zone change versus a physical development scenario. A zone change in and of itself does not generate any traffic. That's why you don't do a traffic impact analysis that you would do if there was a proposal to subdivide the property or do some type of other physical development. Rather, there's state law that requires what's called the transportation planning rule analysis, which basically looks at the zoning level, are we talking about significant changes to planned infrastructure? And what our submitted TPR traffic analysis shows is that as compared to what a worst case scenario under the existing scenario, under the existing zoning, as compared to a reasonable worst case scenario under the proposed zoning, there's negligible, if any, difference in the amount of potential traffic generated, and thus there would be no impacts to any existing or planned transportation systems. And again, I guess I just want to reiterate that if there were a proposal and it hit the applicable thresholds for a traffic analysis, that would be required at the time of physical development. So with that, I guess I just want to wrap up by saying there are should anything actually occur out there, there are additional review processes, and we think that the concerns that have been raised are more appropriately analyzed, and more particularly from an approval criteria standpoint, better addressed at that stage, not at the zoning stage. We think we've selected an appropriate zoning, and there doesn't actually appear to be too much contention in that regard, and we think we otherwise meet the applicable criteria. And I will save the rest for rebuttal, and I'm sure we'll get into scheduling at some later point too, but we envision keeping the record open for additional evidence, doing a rebuttal period and a final argument, and to shape that around the holidays as you deem appropriate.
I had a couple questions.
Sure.
How did the district come to own this property?
I think Ken can get into some better details, but originally I believe it came through a tax foreclosure of a lot of property up there when the farming wasn't going so well, and it was a part of a much larger piece of property up there, and as it's been broken off over 80 years some odd, that's what's left.
Mm-hmm. And then either you or representative from the district can maybe answer this question too. Does the district itself as a public body have some sort of any kind of public process that it uses to determine the appropriate use of its property?
Well, we don't have sort of a land use application type process, but yes, we are governed by an elected board who has to make all decisions on the record, including entering into contracts. People are allowed to speak at all these meetings when those types of issues come on the agenda. So it is an open process.
All right. Thanks.
Thank
Anyone else from the applicant?
You want to say anything?
Sure.
Evening, sir. My name's Ken Reek. I am the district manager for the irrigation district out there.
How do you spell your last name?
R-I-E-C-K. And, yeah, we obtained the properties in the 30s from you guys, from the county sheriff's auction. So we've had it for quite a bit of time. It's been mined for most of that through the years. What they mined out of there was white pumice. It went into things like washing jeans and stuff like that. And so that resource kind of went out and went off the bottom of the chart. So the properties, it took us quite a few years to reclaim it. And we went through the whole process, and it did develop some issues, and we went through that process and finally got it reclaimed and replanted, and it's been replanted now for about 5 years. So it's starting to come back, but it is still definitely disturbed ground. We looked at a lot of different options for this property a lot of different ways to develop it and what we could do with it. We are hold it in trust for the patrons of the district, and we have a fiscal responsibility to maximize the value of the property. We feel that since we're an irrigation district, our maximum value is through piping, water conservation programs, such like that. We lose approximately 50% of our water that we divert out of the stream into the bottoms of canals. We can actually restore a lot of the stream flows just by piping, taking that water that used to seep into the bottom of the canal and putting that back in stream. So far, we've piped over 11.5 miles of our, 7.5 miles of our 11 miles of main canal. It's quite expensive proposals to lay that much pipe. This is 84-inch diameter pipe. So the board has directed us to use property sales to provide seed money for development and putting the pipe in the ground. So that's what we do. We actually own quite a bit of property over the last 20 years that we've disposed of, everything from the backside of Aubrey Butte on down through this piece. This is our last significant piece we own. And at once this is gone, we won't have any properties left. So I look at it as kind of trading assets for assets. So we have this big asset and property, and we trade that for pipe, and then we put the pipe in the ground. So that's our whole conservation plan in a nutshell. The talk about possibly on the non-significant resource list is if we do have to build a re-reg reservoir, that potential piece of property there is a site that we could use. We haven't done any engineering on that, even conceptually at the moment, but it's something that we thought of, and we figured it would be easier to get that done right now than later. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I can't speak to the staff report or anything. I'm not an expert in planning, so but I can talk about pipe.
Thank you. All right, great. Did you both sign in?
I will.
Is there anyone else for the applicant? All right, is there anyone who would like to speak in favor of the application? All right. Are there people who would like to speak in opposition to the application, or who might just want to make a comment or ask a question? Come on up, sir.
Got some written comments for you.
All right, just for the record, this is a memo from Central Oregon Land Watch dated December 12, 2017, with an attachment. 9-page letter with an attachment, and that's going to be hearing exhibit number one.
Okay. Hi, so my name is Rory Isbell. I'm a staff attorney with Central Oregon Land Watch. First, thank you, Hearings Officer Olson, for being here tonight and hearing comments on this application. LandWatch urges you to deny both the plan amendment and zone change applications before you today. To start off, the threshold issue that we think you need to address is the fact that the subject property is agricultural land by definition, and the application erroneously states the contrary. So Goal 3 and the Oregon Administrative Rules that implement Goal 3 state that lands in eastern Oregon that are classified as Class 1 through 6 east of the Cascades are categorically agricultural lands. Further, it's the policy of the state of Oregon to, of course, preserve the maximum amount of agricultural land in the state. That's also in statute. Because the subject property is agricultural land, it should be rezoned to an exclusive farm use zone. Most of the land surrounding the subject property is zoned EFU and consists of the same soils as those found on the subject property. This, interestingly, includes an adjacent former pumice mine, which was rezoned to exclusive farm use following exhaustion of that mineral resource on that site and following adequate restoration of the site reclamation. The same result of rezoning to an exclusive farm use zone should occur on the subject property before you today. A related issue is that because the subject property is agricultural land, any rezoning to a non-exclusive farm use zone requires exceptions to goals 3, 4, and 14. And the current application does not seek those goal exceptions. It does propose to rezone from surface mining to MUA 10 acre minimum / rural residential exception area. The Deschutes County Comprehensive Plan states that as of 2010, any new rural residential exception areas need to be justified through taking exceptions to farm, forest, public facilities and services and urbanization regulations and follow guidelines set out in the Oregon Administrative Rules. So the subject property is not recognized by the county and never has been recognized as an exception area in our comprehensive plan. Of course, an exception area can only exist where an exception has been taken in an acknowledged comprehensive plan, and because none has been taken for the subject property, it's not an exception area of any kind. So Deschutes County Code 18.136.020 requires that a zone change will serve the public health, safety, and welfare. The proposed rezoning to MUA 10 would not serve the public health, safety, and welfare because what the record shows on the site is that the fill material on the site is really demonstrably unstable. Any development of the site under MUA 10 zoning would pose significant danger. This is shown in local media reports, one from earlier this year, which I've attached as an exhibit in the written comments in front of you there, and also in some of the documentation that we have from Dogami. These show that sinkholes have developed on the property back in 2008 and then up to as recently as earlier this year, which is what that media report shows. So a 2008 Dogami inspection found large sinkholes and erosion on the site, and it set as a condition of approval for reclamation that no sinkholes can form for a period of 3 years. Now, the site has been excavated up to 150 feet, it looks like, so odds are that sinkhole formation is likely to continue, which would not be to the benefit of the public health, safety, and welfare that is required by rezoning the property to MUA 10. So as you've heard, a sort of related issue is when Dogami did approve reclamation of the site, they certified 403 acres to be reclaimed to a post-mine use of open space / range. The proposed uses allowed in MUA 10 are, of course, uses other than open space and range, and those uses would be flatly incompatible with Dogami's reclamation determination. So the applicant also they've stated potential future plans to really continue mining the site in order to excavate an irrigation recharge reservoir, but they're also before you today to remove the site from the county's inventory of significant Goal 5 mineral resources. The Oregon Administrative Rules that implement how we designate and coal fired resources and specifically mineral and aggregate resources. They allow for mining only of those resources that are on a significant inventory list. Accordingly, only sites listed on Deschutes County's surface mining mineral and aggregate inventory can be mined as mineral resources, as the applicant has stated, likely future plans to do. So we're concerned because, you know, we don't think the applicant can have the site taken off the county's list of significant mineral resources while also professing these future plans to extract minerals from the site to construct this recharge reservoir. Another issue to bring to your attention, the main road that runs through the property, Bill Martin Road, it's the subject of pending litigation right now. And the broad issue of that litigation is whether the applicant tonight or Deschutes County is responsible for the maintenance of that road. A somewhat likely outcome of that litigation is that Bill Martin Road was approved and constructed through the subject property in violation of the applicable land use regulations. So Deschutes County Code 22.20.015A provides that if any property is in violation of applicable land use regulations, the county shall not make any other land use decisions concerning that property. So because that litigation is pending and the likely outcome is that the road violates applicable land use regulations, a decision on the current application should be postponed until resolution of that litigation. So to conclude, the subject property is agricultural land under state law for which no GOLA exceptions have been taken, and it should be rezoned to an exclusive farm use zone. The evidence sort of shows that inadequate reclamation of the site has resulted in really consistent sinkhole formation and erosion on the site, and Dogami's approval of a post-mine use for just open space and range and not residential uses or any other uses is pretty consistent, I think, with that instability of the site. So it's pretty clear that a public safety danger exists on the site, and rezoning it to allow rural residential development is contrary to state law, the Deschutes County Comp Plan, and Deschutes County Code. That's all. Thanks.
Let me
sure.
I haven't had an opportunity to read this yet, so let me just make sure my notes are accurate and I'm at least have a general understanding of your argument. So you're saying that the original designation that was placed on this property, there was no exception taken at that time.
That's correct.
And so therefore you would need an exception now mm-hmm. to do anything other than EFU.
Right.
Or some resource designation.
Right.
So then, I'm recalling the statute, is it your position then that I don't even have jurisdiction to hear this matter? Because I think only plan amendments to exceptions, plan amendments that require an exception don't go to the hearings officer? Is that correct?
I think. I'd have to double check on that as well, but that is a distinct possibility here.
All right. What and can you tell me a little more about this litigation? Is it between the county and the district? Or?
So I'm not extremely familiar with that litigation. I know there are others in the room that I think you'll probably hear from tonight that are. So questions on that are probably best directed towards them.
All right. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you signed in?
I did, yes.
All right. Is there anyone else who would like to speak in opposition or just make a comment or question? Yes, ma'am.
My name is, I have a bad voice tonight, too. My name is Linda Wohlers, and I reside at 64474 Coyote Run Lane in Tumalo.
Could you spell your last name, please?
Wohlers. And I live actually right where, I live right on the border of this particular property that we're talking about. It has been used, public use of it has been going on for over 30 years between hiking and biking and horseback riding and all that. I believe the gentleman from Central Oregon Land Watch really covered everything that I was going to concur with, and that is that I also believe that the MUA 10 is not the most valid rezoning plan for this area, that the EFU, in this case the EFU Tumalo Redmond Bend, so TRB, is a much lower, would have a much lower impact on this property. If you look at the whole area, and he mentioned this also, this particular property is surrounded almost exclusively by the EFU. There are two small, I don't know if you have the map or not. Did you give him that map of the...
We have this one up here on the...
No, okay. There's another... Let me give you this one. Hold on a second here. Got one that doesn't have my writing on the back of it.
Okay.
And the little red area is actually just all the kind of
yeah. All right. Okay. Great. So I'm going to call this hearing Exhibit 2. It's a Deschutes County Property Information Zoning Map for Account 150783. Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, if you look at this, it's basically surrounded by EFU TRB. There are two small MUA 10 areas. Ironically, one of them is where I live. I'm in the MUA 10 area in the lower right-hand side of it. And it is, I believe it was developed in the 70s. And I doubt very highly that any of those kind of developments should happen in today's rezoning. I looked at the purpose of an MUA 10 to improve the quality of the air, water, and land resources of the county, and I'm concerned about the quality of the air because it is a pumice mining, an old pumice mine. I am concerned about the water quality, and is there enough water if more wells, and I don't have a clue if this would ever happen, but we all are on wells in that area. And already there have been two wells that have dried up just above us due to the use of water in some of the commercial interests that have developed in that area. And I am concerned about that. And it also says that the purpose of the MUA 10 is to conserve open spaces and protect natural and scenic resources. That area is gorgeous. I've taken many pictures of it. It's beautiful. And somehow I can't see that cluster of any kind of housing development would really benefit the natural and scenic resources of that area. So I am basically in concurrence with everything that the gentleman from Central Oregon Land Watch has said. And I too have heard, I can't tell you exactly the Bill Martin Road. I do know that the sinkhole, there was a major sinkhole right on the Bill Martin Road. And I spoke to two different people in the area that stated that that road should never have been built where it was put in across that area because it's the lowest point in that, it's the lowest level in that mining district area. And the road literally had a huge sinkhole in it. Which was pretty amazing. So thank you for your time, sir, and for listening to me.
Great.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. Did you sign in?
I did sign in.
Great. All right. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Jerry Barss, J-E-R-R-I-B-A-R-S-S. I did sign in. I live at 64473 Coyote Run Lane. And my house also borders on the TID property. A lot of this is way over my head. But there were a couple things that I had concerns about. One was the sinkholes and how anything could ever be developed out there. I just think of what happened at Summit High School and just think that anything that's put out there will, I'm also thinking that around the boundary of where the actual mining was, there's just such little amounts of border that anything could be developed there anyway. The other thing that concerns me is the whole area is in the biological deer range, and I read the part that ODFW mentioned about they were okay with anything with the MUA 10. They just wanted to make sure that there was deer-friendly fencing, and I think that there's more than that should be taken into consideration. The recharge reservoir, any water that's in the area will ice up in the wintertime, and deer have issues with ice in the wintertime. And so I don't think a big 10-acre lake would be a good idea for the deer range. I just found out what Dogami is, and I was reading that they designated the post-mining use as the open space range. I understand that they don't have land use, but I still don't understand why it needed to be changed. The other thing that I was told was the MUA 10 clusters can actually be smaller than 10 acres, that you can take the average over the entire property and take them down to, I was told two things, 7.5 acres or 2 acres. So that would be something that might concern me, that there's cluster, yes, but they're going to be smaller cluster, you know, more housing per acre or more development per acre than anything else. So that's all I think I have. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Next. Yes, ma'am.
Good evening. My name is Nancy Gould. I am a Tumalo Irrigation District patron, and I live across Highway 20, probably 3 miles from this property. I was involved in making public comment at the time that Bill Martin Road was put through the property, and I am aware of some of the issues that are ongoing with that regarding who is responsible for the maintenance of that road. At the time that road was put in, it was identified to be the road that would serve the rest of the development of the property. And at the time that road was put in, there was great discussion about open space. And so I'm kind of curious as to how the access points are planned to serve this property. In previous plans for this property, there was discussion of accessing it off of Mock Road. There also was discussion of accessing it on Tumalo Reservoir Road, which would be west of where Bill Martin Road hits Tumalo Reservoir Road, so further to the left of, as you look at the map. Also, as part of the development of Bill Martin Road, there's a cul-de-sac on the north end of that because ODOT does not allow transportation to enter Highway 20. And that, if you looked at a regional map, the north portion cul-de-sac of Bill Martin Road is opposite the southerly end of Gherking Market Road. So applicant does not want to address where open space will be located, saying this will be done at a later time. An applicant wants the property moved to a non-resource surface mine list where SE is not required. So I'd like to know today where open space is to be kept and whether the social value of that open space is for the Tumalo community, not just for TID board members to negotiate with next landowners. Today, the piping project that TID, through OWEB funds, Phase 4 and 5, is not on the subject property and not even near the subject property. That work is in Township 17, Range 11. So the property under review today in Township 16, Range 11, Section 36, has no piping project associated with it. So there's no basis today to grant any rights to any mining for any lake on the subject property today or any association to such lake into the future. The record has no basis, map, or fact to connect any future lake to any water conservation piping project that TID has in place today. Additionally, an evaporating lake of 10 acres is the antithesis of water conservation, for which piping is being done to conserve water and to prevent seepage and to prevent evaporation. If the applicant is proposing a lake, then there's no evidence in the file as to where that's planned today. The hearings officer certainly cannot provide future carve-outs where the applicant has the burden of proof. In fact, the hearings officer must specifically address that there's no approval for any lake on the subject property. The subject property has a pond, which you'll see on the south side of the most horizontal line on the screen below the yellow line. That little round, dark little dot. Do you see what I'm talking about?
No, let me see. I see a dot right below the property. That one. So that's, is that just off the property?
No, the property boundary is the blue line.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, great.
And so the yellow line represents where the estimated, and I just want to say again, estimated, according to their own exhibit, pumice mining boundary. Mm-hmm. So that little pond that you see there, within a stone's throw of Tumalo Reservoir Road, is that which manages the property's surface water rights. Please distinguish these two very unique issues. Water rights that are appurtenant to that land don't need a lake, and there isn't a site for a lake. TID's piping, currently underway, has no lake. And so I think the little footnote that's in the burden of proof statement and in the further supplemental burden of proof that seems to be such a little thing is actually a very big thing here. TID's Tumalo Reservoir, which is probably 4 or 5 miles west of this subject property, today doesn't allow TID members to enjoy its waters. So the question is, what precisely would TID members be entitled to enjoy of any future 10-acre lake on the subject property? It seems that the ESSI needs to be performed today to assure the community of what will be kept open space and how that open space can be used and whether any future lake on the property has public benefit. If the property is moved to non-surface mining table, there comes with this no ESSI. I think the ESSI is needed today. Please make as a condition of approval the applicant show where open space will be kept and to whose benefit this open space will be. Is the open space for wildlife? Is it only for those who own one of the proposed MUA parcels? Is it for pedestrians, horses, bicyclists, water sports activities? I think it's ludicrous and irresponsible for Deschutes County to allow parceling of the 540 acres into smaller lots without any engineered backfill post-mining. Clearly, Dogami, in its open space requirement, did not want the lands built upon. And clearly, there is no record that engineered backfill occurred. I have a little attachment that will share with you that it cost the Bend School District $7 million to deal with a 20-acre parcel that had not been properly engineered. They built on an unengineered parcel just west of this building here on a former pumice pit. They put their track in, their softball fields or baseball diamonds or whatever it was, and over time the thing collapsed because it did not have engineering backfill. That's important because this property was reclaimed but didn't get any stamp of it being engineered backfill. So some assumption that you can just build on it is just truly not there. An applicant does talk a little bit in their materials just saying, well, that cost could be borne in the future by a developer or by a property owner. I think we're really getting ahead of ourselves, and this property needs to be analyzed today for what it can support. If Deschutes County is approving parceling, it must provide into the record that the property has no past hazards from past mining. Additionally, if the county wants to approve parceling the property, the road that serves the property, Bill Martin Road, must be brought into public road standards and also into public funding for maintenance. Otherwise, I think the county and TID will forever be subject to expenses where Bill Martin Road will be used by proposed MUA parcels. So as soon as the property is removed from these lists, the next property owner will not be prepared to understand what the history of their parcel has been. That's part of the public safety that I'm trying to get to. Applicants want double standard. It wants to be removed from the surface mining, minerals, and aggregate inventory, and also to be removed from SMEA, but then it wants to be able to mine for the lake. It wants to be on the non-surface mining mineral and aggregate inventory list, which is exempt from SE, but states that future land processes are where SE issues would be reviewed. It says the mining resources have been depleted, but it wants to be able in future to remove lake materials. The public interest of rezoning is not met if the intent is to mine the property in the future, where adjacent properties would not be required to be notified by the applicant if the county removes the SMEA overlay. Until Deschutes County can provide an engineered backfill report, it's premature to rezone the property to MUA 10. Until any lake is mined, it's premature to remove from SMEA. And until the open space is identified that was discussed many years ago in previous petitions, it's premature to grant MUA status without showing where that open space will be located, for whom the open space will be, and that the open space is safe. So the other issue I'd like to bring to your attention is that ODOT did not grant access from the north cul-de-sac of Bill Martin Road, and yet there are vehicles that are exiting the property and turning directly onto Highway 20. I think that if more parcels are created on this property, there will be much greater likelihood of continuing to pressure to access onto Highway 20, and I don't think that permission has been granted by ODOT. So again, in the county's road department report, they talk about accesses on Tumalo Reservoir Road, and I think at issue is to understand where accesses historically in the past have been identified, whether any of those are continued to be used, and if not, what the development pressure patterns are going to be to access directly onto Highway 20. And most people like to go the fastest, straightest pattern they can. I think the circulation pattern needs to be thought about in the context of this development. Adding more parcels, more MUA parcels, I believe, will add more unpermitted travel directly onto Highway 20 opposite Gherkin Market Road. This should be avoided as it places our community at risk. And I do have the article that talks about the sinkholes. I'll read just one paragraph. As early as 1990, a construction firm hired by the school district to prepare the school site had warned that the nearly 20 acres identified for athletic fields was potentially unstable. The firm recommended a $5 million solution that would have removed all of the soil down to the bedrock, then refilled the hole and compacted the soil layer by layer. That's what engineered backfill looks like, and you actually get a stamped engineered stamp from an engineer stating that the layers can support development above. The school did not choose that option. The ultimate fix was largely identical to what contractors had suggested the first time around. That was after the sinkholes opened up under the field. And beginning in July 2007, crews began digging up the fields, going down 35 feet and excavating an estimated 1.4 million cubic yards of soil. They then put a drainage system at the base of that, and they did their engineered backfill with water and tamping to create a stable surface for the new fields. And I believe that as a water patron, I'm going to be on the hook for this remediation that's needed here. And I think we're really getting ahead of the horse. I think that cost needs to be put out now to understand what stabilizing the soils are for this entire property. Thank you.
Thank you. And you signed in?
I will.
And do you have a copy of your testimony that you're going to leave with me?
Or? Yeah, I do.
Okay, thank you. Okay, just for the record, this is testimony dated December 12, 2017, with an attachment from Nancy Gold. All right, next. I have any other? Yes, young man.
Travis Worth, WIRTH. I live at 64645 Mock Road. We had our well go dry last spring. It cost us $38,000 to drill a new one.
as the old one was no longer viable. Believe the applicant is stipulating that these new parcels will stand alone, their own wells, their own septic systems. I'm just curious, it appears that there's been a relatively exhaustive study as far as traffic goes. Does anyone have any idea what approximately 50 new wells would do to the water table in the surrounding area? And frankly, if the local people are going to be able to afford such expenses to drill new wells if need be. That's my concern.
Where's your property in relationship to this one?
It is directly adjacent to the west, just about midline of the property.
Okay. Next. Sir?
I've signed in. My name is Jim Holt, 64855 Bill Martin Road. It was the operator of the pit, Pumice Mining, who made the decision as to how they would refill the holes that they dug as they mined the pumice, cinders, and possibly in contention sand and gravel. Dogami has, as was indicated, no land use position, but they do have a use of land position, reversing those two words. And they are concerned about the use of the land after it's been mined and refilled. And if the refill isn't done in a responsible manner that can allow construction on it, then they have to degrade their suggestions, not law, but their suggestion as to what it should be accounted for. The entire report that I read from the applicant left out a lot of firmness on details of what's going to happen. They put in as much as they had to, but they left out a lot of other stuff or innuendos. The innuendos in the information their traffic study person put in was there's going to be 53 10-acre parcels. Probably not true. And a lot of other places, the same way. The innuendos are there that something's going to happen that isn't. The innuendos were that they were highly in favor of maintaining a rural status of it. You can see that's probably the case because the last area they developed in mostly 20-acre and larger sizes. And interesting enough, just around the corner of Laidlaw Butte, the upper blue line that you're looking at there above the red line, they're all the same. They're all the same. Just above that blue line, there are, up on the hillside, four 20-acre properties, two from the county, two from TID, that are on EFU land. And that land is treed and rocky and sloping, but it's EFU, and it's been EFU for a long time. And they were allowed by the county to build CUP, conditional use permit, properties and houses on those lands without a problem at all. So to go to an MUA 10 only has one real value to TID, and that is after they get it approved, after they keep talking about how great 10 acres is by maintaining a nice area there, then they're allowed to go to a cluster development, which will just decimate the area as far as its usage. The paper you're looking at, or the map you're looking at, the yellow outline, is what's called by Dogami a disturbed area. That entire area within the yellow line was disturbed to some extent, to include also the add-on of the area inside the red line. difference is one of them they mined cinders out of it, and one they mined pumice out of. And then there was also some sand and gravel mined out of that upper northwest corner, or as you're looking at the map, the upper left-hand corner of the yellow. Dungannon has chosen in its portrayal of the land's usage that they're trying to assist people in knowing what that land is. Also, that area up there that is just to the slightly upper and to the right of the orange line, it has a circle around it, that's the very top peak, for the most part, of the Laidlaw Butte. What's significant about that is actually a rimrock area that the county covers under special building codes. So there's going to be a lack of building up on top of that rimrock or even up against it from the bottom side. And that's covered by county codes. The choice was made to build a road to access 200 acres on the east side and the north side of Laidlaw Butte that were then developed. That choice was made to get the road in there, and the engineering firm that chose or asked to be chosen to engineer the dirt road itself went to TID and asked them in print, where do you want to put the road? And TID drew on a map of the area where they wanted the road to go. Sounds fine to you. Everything's great. Except, as you'll see later on, that road was built on fill that later collapsed, fill that wasn't properly engineered. And what the only thing that surprised me is when they decided to do it, because they knew what had been mined, they made the decision to go ahead and put it there, even though if you look in TID's contract documents, it tells you very specific, when you build for us and you use fill, you will use what would be called engineered fill, and that is you will fill no more than 12-inch layers at a time, wet it down, and compact it. Yet they built a road on soil that underneath was many feet deep. What concerns me was something, a comment made in relationship to the 200 acres that were developed on the other side of the butte in a TID board meeting by their former lawyer, which seems to maybe represent how they feel, and that is caveat emptor. And he stated right there that if you buy property out here, it's up to you to know everything about it. Buyer beware. That doesn't really work so much with real estate. But that's what the lawyer felt, and that lawyer advised TID, buyer beware. My feeling is I'm concerned about the next guy who buys an MUA 10 property out there in the middle of that pit, that who's going to tell him that there's non-engineered fill 150 feet deep underneath the property you just bought. Somebody needs to be aware that MUA 10 could work for the forested area around that yellow lined area, but it would better be done as an EFU with CUPs where they can't consolidate that down to 2-acre parcels and putting a hell of a lot of them in. The comment was made about the traffic impact study. And yes, you have to do a traffic impact study. However, if you look under under Deschutes County 18.116.310, traffic impact study, item capital B, the applicant shall meet with the county staff in a pre-application conference to discuss study requirements, then generate the traffic study and submit it concurrently with the land use application. They are saying they submitted a traffic study. However, it's somewhat flawed in that if you read down to the next level, capital C, and you read to paragraph 3, it tells you that there's actually two different types of traffic studies done. One is a peak traffic between 4 and 6 p.m. on a day, and they assign that a figure of 1 for each car, truck, vehicle. And there's another one that in the traffic handbook for traffic engineers, it tells you that for every household you have, you're going to allow 10 trips per 10 trip ins per day. The county just used that on a piece of property that they'd sold prior, basically where you see the far upper left hand or right hand line of yellow. There's a piece of property right up in that area that they sold already, and when the county did a CUP on that, they indicated the same thing, 10 per. And then under number 3, it says, no report is required if there are fewer than 50 trips per day generated during a weekday. Well, if there's going to be 53 houses out there per the traffic study stating, you'd have 53 or 54 1 p.m. trips. And at 10 per lot, you'd have 540 trips per day. Site traffic report in STR, if the development is going to be providing 50 to 200 daily trip-ins or 20 peak hour trips, well, again, those are both exceeded. And the last one is there must be a traffic impact analysis if the development or change in use will generate more than 20 trip-ins and 200 or more peak hour trips. That one fits. They didn't do the traffic impact study, and they're saying, gee, we want to develop this area out here, but we don't want to decide in print for anybody to see what we're planning on doing or how many we're going to put in or how we're going to do it. So we can't possibly tell you how many houses there's going to be out here because we don't want to. Therefore, how can we do a traffic study? They're going to have to guess. They already have some idea of what they want to do because they already know how much money they want to make off this land when they sell it for the repiping. So they got to complete at some point in time or they're all messed up on their traffic study, which they haven't submitted yet to any of these specs. They also have to come up with the nearest intersection of the Tumalo Reservoir Road as to how much traffic impact it will indicate there if there's 25 additional peak hour trips over and above. What they did initially was they said, since this is a mined area and mined areas are not classified in the traffic engineer's book, that we'll just turn around and run some tests that have been done around the state as to how many trip-ins we've had in various locations and make some assumptions from those and divide them all up. And they average them out, and they said, well, if you average all these out, you have 0.66 trips per acre. If you're developing 540 acres, you're going to have 0.66 times 540. Now, there's a real figure they can put their hands around and use. So two-thirds of 540 is 347 trip-ins. Gee, that far exceeds the item C, traffic impact analysis. So I think they have their answer already. They have not submitted the paperwork yet per what is really required. They've submitted a report that leaves out their best guess. But even if they leave out that best guess, they are what they used of 0.66 times 540 requires a full traffic study, a full TIA, as they tell it, in their own, in the county's own requirements. You probably saw something like this in your paper you already have. You should have received that. This was done by a company called DEA, and that's not Drug Enforcement Agency. And when they did it, they too worked with Cascade Pumice for a number of years. And on it, when you read it, you'll see that it's color-coded very nicely. And there's one color on here that's purple, and it lines up with these two ladies that just spoke. And it tells you that with the 250-foot buffer in between, their houses are next to 150 feet of loose fill. That's probably pretty safe. 250 feet is probably pretty safe. But 250 feet across is already enough to build a house on. I know that because when Tumalo divided up the property that they sold out there into 20-acre sections, it was 330 feet across. So you could theoretically sell that 250 and have somebody build on it, and they'll be building on a 150-foot precipice of loose fill right in front of their house. Nobody's going to tell them. Somebody's got to do something. They also went through several areas here, and they showed it had 0 feet of fill, which would lend you to believe that you could sell that property as a house. The only problem you have with that is when you go out and look at that, and you might want to go out and look, you'll find out there's two long hills on there. And those two hills don't line up with any of the topographical of this valley that used to be there. If you look at one of the oldest prints that you have of the aerial photograph, you'll see a line of trees, just a very thin line, that move basically from the lowest right-hand yellow line on there, move basically diagonal across to the center of the right-hand vertical line. That was the old drainage that went through there. That's how the water flowed off of the land that's higher on the south side, the bottom side of Tumalo Reservoir Road. Now it's 40, 45 feet below level, and so any water that flows into there will flow in and help collapse the whole area. And when you, and the problem is Dogami on record looks at in pretty much 3 years of no collapse, they figure that's fine, normal rainfall. But we had last year a very different snow melt rainfall combination. And that's what caused all the terrific collapses. You'll see in the paperwork that I submitted to staff, you'll see some pictures of the collapses out there. Some of the collapses are 20, 30 feet long, 10, 15 feet deep, 10, 20 feet wide. They've all been covered up now by a tractor. But all they did was they took some dirt from the side of the collapse and moved it into the collapse and smoothed it out. Nothing really was done. It gets wet again, it's going to collapse again one day. These two hills I spoke about are not hills. They're not natural hills. What they are is they are when the operator, Cascade Pumice, pushed the overburden up and out of the way to hold it there until they got ready to refill. They made these, actually there's a third hill over next to Mock Road. They made these three hills, they just never pushed them back down into the openings. Never filled it out, leveled the whole place out. And if you look at the back of the second color map that I sent, you'll see a picture from 1984, showing that the red area where it says pumice mine, it says 1968 perimeter, you'll see that's exactly where those hills are. There's a mine that's been refilled underneath those hills. But TID paid David Evans to come in and draw him a map, and somebody forgot to tell David Evans, or David Evans hasn't been around that long, that distance of time of 1968, haven't been around long enough to realize that they mined underneath those, pushed overburden up, and that overburden was never properly compacted either. Now a little bit of background that you were promised. And this is backing up for you why, according to the Chute's own rules, if there's a land use problem being dealt with, in the courts especially, they've decided that that's a big enough issue that we shouldn't make a decision until that land use, whatever it be, is solved. the state of Oregon, back sometime before 85, I didn't write this down, decided that too many developers were not acting in good stewards of our land. Passed a law stating that 3 lots are created in 1 calendar year as subdivisions created. Simple, it's a law. In 85, a landholder in Deschutes County created 4 or more lots in the same year, sold them, and the state of Oregon decided that wasn't right. He said, gee, I didn't know, and they turned around and said, that's okay, you got 5 years in jail. So the Oregon land laws are, in subdivisions at least, are pretty explicit, and they believe in them. We're doing the same thing here. TID and the county went together on an administrative agreement and did 20 parcels in 1 year. I'm sorry, not 20, 10. 10 in 1 year, totaling about 200 acres. You're supposed to leave, when you have a subdivision, which they chose not to call it that, you're supposed to leave some open space. They forgot. So now that area is real close to being settled by the courts because the judge can't see any reason why it isn't going to be a subdivision. It's a state law. They violated the law big time. The way they did it was they took one parcel and partitioned it into 2 lots, went and had it approved by the county. Oregon Land Watch turned around and said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't quite right. You're destroying EFU land by putting a house on it. LUBA was brought into it, and LUBA says, well, yeah, but we'll allow it. It will allow the road to be put in. And as soon as they did that, and that was legal, and they could have put those 2 partitions in that year and had been all set. Instead, they immediately lumped on a total of 10, 4 more, to give a total of 10. So they passed it through LUBA as 2 simple lots, and as soon as LUBA agreed to it, they turned around and said, yeah, the lawyer from the current law firm representing TID alerted them to the fact that there was some sort of a problem. They must talk to about it in secret because it doesn't come out in print, but the lawyer said, gee, let's just submit 1 partition, 2 part, or 1 parcel with 2 partitions and see how that goes first. The reason this was important to us was because it requires a county or a state agency to maintain the road provided by a subdivision, state rule, and Deschutes backed both those rules up in their paperwork. It also states that if a developer owns land contiguous to that being developed, like 540 acres are very contiguous to the 200, they must have a report and a map of any future planned development they're going to be making in that area. So TID is basically said because they didn't adhere to the subdivision rules, they didn't put this map out, so nobody knows what their plans are. They're just kind of in the back room winging it and telling us out in front a little bit and hoping we'll believe it and walk away. So TID proposes converting the SM zone to MUA-10. Not a bad idea. I'd rather see EFU. It makes more sense for Oregon. A few problems. I already mentioned one was rimrock non-development. It's already been mentioned that the deer winter year-round habitat migration issue. And, in fact, if you look at the map again up on the top up there in the very upper area there, you'll see a green area. That particular green area has a type of deer or wildlife management attached to it already when that property was last sold. And TID was the seller of that property at one point in time. Not the last time it was sold, somebody else was the seller, but had that attached. Citing unnecessary lake. Why do I say unnecessary? TID is building this huge underground lake in all of their pipes that they'll eventually have instead of open canals, which you see all the time. They'll save a lot of water. And they'll have a lot of water entering that piping system. And their proud proclamation, I believe it worked, is that now everyone will just have to open a valve and they can fill up their own pond, or they can power their own sprinklers directly without a pump, saving energy on it. And maybe someday all of this water that they've saved will be there when they have a shortage of water someday. Very rarely have they ever had shortages. They've had a few way back. But when they do have a shortage, they can make it up with water they've saved because they've got all this water that they can use. They've got X number of acres of water that they can use. So they want to put in a pipeline or a lake way down here when it's about 4 miles, 5 miles away to their major pipeline, which empties into a huge reservoir. Why are we building a new lake down here when all they have to do is put a valve system on the end of this huge pipe they're putting in and put a pump on the lake, and when they start running short of water and there's not enough of the creek to make it up, turn the pump on and pump it out of the Tumalo Reservoir. We don't need to make more lakes down here. And the problem is they're not telling anyone where they're going to put the lake, but in reality, if you look at that yellow area, you can't put the lake there. That's all non-engineered fill. And you're going to put 10 acres of water, 6, 10 feet deep or more. They're not talking about that either, how much they're going to put in there. And that water, then that moisture gets underneath there during the winter, and that lake sinks. There's a problem. And they're sure not going to put it in the unmined areas because that's at a real premium right now for building houses in the unmined areas to make money, because when you can't build a house on a non-engineered fill, which anybody in his right mind is going to realize that a decent engineer is going to come in there and try to figure out how to build on unengineered fill, not very economical. They do have a hazard on the property, but it's not a natural hazard. It's one they created themselves by allowing cascade pumice to backfill loose. The purpose of a SMIA is to protect the significant mineral and aggregate inventory from non-usage due to surrounding uses, i.e. people with houses too close. They're going to get dusted real bad. And there's a number of people in here that have been dusted pretty bad during the time that mine was going. So you change it to insignificant, and you automatically remove the SMIA because you don't need it to protect the mine anymore. But also, when you start re-mining again to put the lake in, you're going to dust everybody around there. County Section 5.1, Introduction to Goal 5 Process for Aggregate Mining, in Step 3 states that once a decision is made, i.e. a CUP, to allow mining, the site should be protected from future off-site uses that could conflict with mining operations. And the county very nicely puts a parenthesis in and says, i.e. new dwellings. The county is sitting here saying, hey, if we give you the permission to go ahead and mine that again, if you can't protect those dwellings from the wind picking up that pumice and dusting them every day like they used to do with the old pumice mine, then you're not protecting them. So the Oregon Department of Conservation and Development says Goal 5 must identify and analyze ESEE consequences of potential new conflicting use which could occur with the impact area, even though it's not labeled anymore. I want to call attention to the county staff report claims that 312.75 acres have been reclaimed and approved by Dogami for open space range, but they left off the other acreage that when added to it makes it 403. So it's in one place it's okay, in another it's not. So you'll see in this here where Dogami approves the 403. you'll see pictures in the new one I handed in, not the older one with the color on it, but you'll see pictures of a hole in the gutter of the road that goes underneath and just swallows up all the water that was coming out back in March. A little bit farther down, you'll see a picture with a white square in the dead center of it. And if you look just over the top of that white square, the white square says danger, no trespassing. Just over that, that big open area that has no weeds, rabbit brush, or whatever in it, that's one of those sinkholes. The next one, you'll see a hillside, a curving hillside with trees on it, a patch of, looks like snow, and right below it there's a gash right across that snow of another one that developed. And the one below it, dead center in that picture, is another large open sinkhole. And the next one, in the very center of that one, you see another huge sinkhole, and another one a little bit smaller in front of it. And next one down, you'll see trees with a power line sticking out of the top, with another sinkhole that's been covered up by their tractors. You'll see two tractors down there. So you have to understand probably how we got this loose fill. It's very definitely described by Dogami in Dogami's papers. And next question may be, somebody may say, how did I get all this stuff? Because I'm a party to this lawsuit, we received the information from, or from somebody else who requested it, from TID, from the county, from DEA, and from Dogami. I have every Dogami report year by year since they started mining 1927. Nobody seems to go back and look at that far back. The way they did the mining was they dug a hole, and the first thing they do is they set aside all the brush and trees. Then they would dig a little bit deeper and set aside all of, in a berm, all of the topsoil. Then they would dig down until they found the pumice or cinders or sand and gravel. And they would set all of that overburden aside. Then they would dig down 20 feet of that out, 50 feet, whatever it took, in addition to overburden. And then when they were done, they moved next to that, next, you know, 50 feet over, 20 feet over. They dug an identical hole. But in their infinite wisdom, it was good wisdom, because TID didn't figure out ahead of time to tell them that they had to compact this. They just let them move forward. And they did that for years, since 1927. They proceeded to dump in the vegetation first into the old hole, followed by rocks and overburden. And in the one that has the colored maps on the front, if you go back in that one a little bit, you'll see pictures where you actually see a bulldozer just shoving loose dirt into a huge hole. You'll see a face wall 60, 80 feet high, and you'll see a dump truck dumping loose overburden in. After they dumped all the overburden and got to the top, and they've done several like this, they'd come back and spread the topsoil, and then they'd seed it. So I think you can kind of see how you dump a bunch of loose dirt on the ground, and then you water it, it's going to have holes in it when you're done. And that's how they did this all. And that's why we have to be very careful giving TID permission to do this, unless somehow we make sure that nobody can ever buy a piece of property out there without knowing exactly what is underneath it. So that means the entire area underneath the yellow line is all overburdened, filled loose, not really saleable unless you're into cheating customers. That's all I have to say.
And where's your property in relation to the...
Essentially, if you take that yellow line and follow it all the way up to the top, and you see the blue line that goes across, my property is just off the map, and it transits about two-thirds of the way to the left. Okay. And it's a half a mile long by 330 feet wide. And there's a total of four of those pieces up on there. Two of them you'd be able to see now. Mine's just off the picture.
Great. Thank you very much.
submitted that.
Oh, yes, yes. Thank you. This, I've entered it in as hearing exhibit 4, 12 pages of testimony from Mr. Holt.
And the other ones are already entered. That was the one you got with the whole packet.
All right. Anyone else in opposition or has a question?
My name is Lynette Rasmussen.
Need to have you sit the microphone there.
My name is Lynette Rasmussen, R-A-S-M-U-S-S-E-N. My husband, Danny Rasmussen, and I would like to concur with Jim Holt's statement and all other statements made in opposition tonight.
Yeah, thank you. Anyone
thank
else?
You.
Yes, sir.
My name is Dan Harrison, and I have a piece of property next to the pumice pit. I've been living there for 35 years, a long time, and seeing all the changes that have come with that property, I have intimate knowledge of the mining operation that was in existence. I bought my property in 1984, and it was supposed to be continued for 3 or 4 years and then discontinued. And 10 years later, they were still mining, and it turned out they were mining without a permit. And they had their permit had expired, and a group of neighbors had filed a class action lawsuit against the Cascade Pumice Company. We suspected that TID was complicit with this knowledge and actually forced them to have to reapply for a surface mining permit. And in doing this, we found all kinds of egregious problems with the pumice, specifically the particulate matter that was toxic. And part of the conditions that we instituted with the lawsuit was that they had to backfill their slots, and these slots were huge, 50, 60 foot face walls, no fencing, and they would dig until somebody blew the whistle on. So they had to confine these slots to smaller dimensions, backfill as they went, instead of they would leave half of that dug open, and now they had to put noise suppression on their backup beepers. They had to have wind monitoring systems. When the wind got to be over 8 miles an hour, they had to cease operations because of the pumice dust was so bad. So none of this was ever properly backfilled, and I think the prior testimony was quite accurate that they just bulldozed whatever they had dug up and went on to the next slot. There's no compaction. There was no engineering of the backfill with this overburden. And so that entire yellow zone is moon dust, to use a term. Nothing grows on it, and nothing has grown in 30 years on it. There's no soil, and there's no moisture to hold seeds, and even the weeds don't even grow on it. And so I think it's particularly poorly suited for a subdivision of MUA. It's not farm country. It's not land you could effectively plant. And without any water, it wouldn't hold water. So I'm not quite sure. I'm in total opposition of this process because I think it's ill-fated and is going to have a lot of ramifications to the negative of trying to sell acreage for houses. So I think it should be left as an open space. I do know a lot of people use it for casual walking and recreating. I think there's value in it for the community and having some spaces that are available for casual recreation. And most of the community that surrounds it is respectful of it and enjoys the open space and the dark skies that's all involved with it. But for building, I think it's particularly poorly suited for that.
And you also indicated you didn't think it would be farmable either because there's no soil?
You water it, there's a 40-foot slot that just pumice. I mean, you can walk on it, but there's nothing to hold water. There's no ground base. There's no bottom to it. And these, I don't think it would be arable land. You'd have to scrape it down. You have to bring in topsoil and fertile soil to get anything to grow. There's a couple of pine trees that were about size of my three-year-old, about as high as he is. And he's 24 years old, and it's only up to his chest. It hasn't grown in 20 years, hasn't grown a foot and a half. So it's scab land, and it's not particularly well suited for farming and for houses, especially MUA 10, where you're going to have animals and fences, and people want to do things with that. I think the EFU might be, because there's a bigger acreage and better suited, less houses, less density. The traffic, the noise, the ingress egress is limited because of the natural topography. So you worry about impacting the neighborhood with unnecessary traffic, and it's just not what the area is designed for. So I'm in great opposition for this proposal.
Great. Thank you. Did you sign in?
I am signing in now.
Anyone else wish to testify? Sir, back in the back.
Yes, my name's Adam Huang.
Here at that.
Sorry. My name's Alan Huang. I want to bring one question. Is a CPU permit need to get the environmental or somebody against it because they need to find the solid rock ground not deeper than 18 inch? Am I right?
We'll have to have maybe staff or the applicant comment on that. To get a conditional use permit?
Yes.
I mean, there has to be a hearing, an application and a hearing, but I'm not sure exactly what the standards are.
Yeah, because I'm trying to build a house, and the county told me that I need to get the soil guy to prove that my land is able to build, because environmental, they don't want anybody to build any house in the area. Am I correct?
Well, there are septic tank rules and other rules for, you know, building a foundation and so on. So, okay, we'll have staff answer that in a minute.
Yeah, it's not a foundation because I don't know what kind of the organization, they don't want to build any, they don't want anybody build the house in the area, except if I can get the civil engineer or the soil guy to prove my land not deeper than 18 inch has a solid rock. It's not suited for farming. And I mean, if that's the pumice land, it's all filled with the dirt. How can they find the solid, you know, the rock not deeper than 18 inch? That's my question.
Okay, make sure you sign in. I'll have to have staff comment here in a moment. Since we've heard from everybody. Anyone else? All right. We're going to, ma'am.
Thank you. My name's Marianne Thomas. I live on Gerking Market Road, about across from across Highway 20, about 3 miles away from the proposed site. I've lived in Tumla for 14 years. It's quite obvious to me that this is a proposition for housing development, 54 new houses on 10-acre plots. Tumalo is all rural, all EFU. There's no precedence for 10-acre plots. I resent the applicant painting this as a water conservation project. I don't understand how that how this entails water conservation. I know that it's the Tumalo Irrigation District. They are stewards of our water. I am a patron of them. We pay several thousand dollars a year to irrigate our lands. But I don't know what 54 wells and a giant lake, I don't know how that is conserving water at all. And it seems to me I'm very concerned about it's obvious that TID and council, their council is trying to fast track this. The idea of let's get the ten acres rezoned and then we'll deal with the public safety issues and the traffic issues is ridiculous to me. I think building 54 houses on a pumice mine that has not been re-engineered is asking for a disaster. Thank you for hearing our comments, and I concur with everyone else who has done great research in opposition to this. I appreciate it.
For your sign in there.
Yes, well.
Okay, so anyone who hasn't spoken wants to speak. I have a feeling there's going to be an open record period, so I'm not going to have people retestify because there'll probably be an opportunity to submit written comments. So I think that's everyone who wishes to testify. Staff, do you have any comments? And maybe you can respond to Mr. Wong's questions.
I will reserve most of my responses to a written memo to the hearings officer, just to address some of the issues, but more importantly, just supplement the application or the file with additional information. To answer the question about the soil study in the farm zone. To build a house, there's several different categories of homes that you can try to get approval for. There's farm-related dwellings. That's if you're actively farming the land and you can show an earned income on it. The most common category is a non-farm dwelling, and that requires a soil study, especially if you've got high-value soils on the land on your land. And so we require a soil study to be done by a professional to prove that the area that you want to put your development, including the septic system, the house, and any other accessory residential structures, is in an area that is generally unsuitable or the least suitable area for farming. So the high-value soils can be preserved for farming in the future or at the present. Currently. So that would be my guess of what the question revolves around. In relation to the proposal before us, they're not proposing to develop right now. excuse me. But when whether it's a cluster development or a subdivision that comes forward, would likely be required some kind of environmental study, transportation study, environmental study to show that the land is suitable for the development. We had a very similar proposal in Terrebonne on a former mine that was also involved studies, environmental studies of the area. So I would I believe that that would also be required if and when development is proposed in the future. Right now, we are just looking at a change of a zone. That's all.
Are you aware of any county code enforcement actions regarding this property?
Central Oregon Land Watch did point to the section of code. That is one area I'm going to check on. Typically, that involves county code enforcement complaints. None of the properties that are involved here have an active code enforcement complaint. The question is, does this, if there is a loss, I don't know what the status of the lawsuit is, but does this apply to, or does that section of a code apply to a lawsuit that is not involved in a local code enforcement case, if that makes any sense. Central Oregon Land Watch did cite the correct section of code. It's procedures ordinance that came into play a couple years ago. This is not a development permit, though, but it is a land use action. So I was going to look into that a little bit more.
All right, great. Thank you. All right, does the applicant have anything you'd like to say?
Thanks for the opportunity for rebuttal. I guess I want to echo much of what Cynthia just said. This is a application for a zone change. It is not an application for physical development. I think most of the testimony you heard tonight was aimed at physical development, which is not on the table. I think also what you heard was that there are procedures in place to evaluate much of the concerns when an application for physical development actually came into the Deschutes County Planning Department for a. And I guess just to make it as simple as possible, this zone change does not authorize construction of a lake. It does not authorize subdividing this property. All it does is change the zoning and plan designation out of surface mining and into another zone. As to what other zone that might be, I think you heard testimony that, not even from us, that the property is not farmable. So how would an EFU designation make any sense? I think you heard testimony that, one, the 10 acres minimum lot size preserves open space and that it's in the purpose statement of the MUA 10 zone. And I don't think you've heard, other than that, I'm not sure you've heard any argument as to why another zone makes more sense. I think all the roads are leading to MUA 10 for the whole parcel. The rest of the issues, I think, we'll be addressing in supplemental submittals and open record period because it's the first time we've had an opportunity to look at them. But I guess I can say that the property has been zoned surface mining since the very start, so it was exception area from the very beginning. That was the only way it could be anything other than EFU, other than a resource land. So the county is processing this application correctly, and that there's no goal exception required because it's always been exception land. And I think if you look at the definition of agricultural land, it also says that exception lands are not agricultural lands. We'll hit on some more of those technical details in the submittal, but I what I think you've heard tonight is that we've met the criteria. People might not like the choice might not like the proposal, but they're fears and opposition is really to some theoretical future development that has not been proposed and is not applicable to the decision that's before you today, which is to what zoning should this be now that the surface mining zone is, or surface mining resource has been depleted. Thank you.
All right. Okay, so my understanding is the applicant has requested additional time for submittals. I'm going to go through the continuance rule here just so everybody understands how this works. In a land use hearing, at the close of the hearing, there are three options. I can close the hearing and make a decision based on the evidence and arguments that have been submitted so far, unless someone asks for a continuance or to have the record be kept open, and the applicant has done that. So then I've got a couple of choices, and most typically what we do is we continue to keep the record open for a period of time. And during the initial period of time, anyone may submit any comments you want that you think are relevant to the application. And then once that period closes, there's a second period, and anyone may submit anything you want that responds to the material submitted during the first open record period. And then finally, there's a period for applicant's final rebuttal, but no evidence. So typically, oftentimes it works out, there's a 7-day anything goes period, 7 days respond to what happened during the first 7 days, and then 7 days for the applicant to rebut. Now, in this case, we don't have a 150-day rule issue because it's a zone change and plan amendment. I don't know. We also have typically it would be 1 week or 2 weeks. 2 weeks is the 26th of December, which is probably not the best day. I'm not inclined to make anybody have to work over Christmas weekend. But I also don't know what the applicant's time frame is, if you have any particular concerns about the timing of this.
I guess if I had my choice, I'd like the evidence period to end before Christmas and then the two latter periods to be beyond the holiday season, well beyond if possible.
Okay. Well, I generally like to keep it the same. Why don't we keep the record open till the 22nd? That's 10 days. So close of business, which is, I assume, 5 o'clock on the 22nd. If you have any comments or evidence that you wish to submit, you have to have it in, physically received by the planning department at 5 o'clock on the 22nd. Don't send it to me. Send it to the planning department. Planning department will make sure that I get it. Then the parties will have 10 days from that date, which will be 1, 2, 3, 4. That'd be the 2nd, I guess, of January, looks like. So close of business on the 2nd of January. Is that going to?
We're closed on the 2nd.
Oh, okay, that's right. You're closed on the 2nd?
Oh, wait, no, Monday. Oh, I'm looking at the wrong.
Monday is the 1st. The only other way to do it is to extend everything a couple of weeks.
We can make that work if that's where we want to go.
Okay. So that would be the close of business on the 2nd, 5 o'clock. That is for material in response to what was submitted during the first 10-day period. If it's not in response to that, if it's beyond that, then it's not going to be considered. And then finally, I'll give the applicant 10 days to submit rebuttal, and that puts that on the, assume that's going to be the 12th, Friday the 12th of January, 5 o'clock, for applicant's final rebuttal and no evidence. So let me just go over this one more time. Close of business day. Close the business on the 22nd, Friday the 22nd. Close the business on Tuesday the 2nd. And close the business on Friday the 12th. Everybody okay with that?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
We have opportunity to review what is submitted.
This is it's always kind of an issue, but staff does everything it can to get it posted as soon as it comes in. But the only safe thing to do is to come down and physically look at it. But they'll make every effort to try to get it posted online. But everybody suffers under the same thing in terms of stuff coming in at the last minute. All right, staff, did you have anything more? Yeah. All right, then I'm going to close the oral portion of this hearing. Thank you very much. I appreciate all the testimony, and have a happy holidays, everybody. You too.